So it's great to be sitting up here with all these other crazy paranoid people. Someone once said the key to a successful life of paranoia is to keep careful track of your persecutors. No. I was told to keep it to about 10 minutes. I've been involved in the issue related to this panel for about 10 years. So that's about 1 minute per year. But if I talk fast enough, I think we can get through it. Even with that time constraint, I never give any kind of talk or presentation without making sure the acknowledgments are done. And as always, thanks to my wife and my son and my daughter, my family in general, for their love and support. I also want to acknowledge my funding sources. You got to be pretty creative. This is also my disclosure. I have been funded by these guys that I'll talk about, Novartis, Syngenta, and their colleagues. And I also want to acknowledge the students, both past and present, that have been involved in the work that I'm going to talk to you about. So I got asked a few years ago, about 12 years ago, to examine a chemical called atrazine. It's a so-called S-chlorotriazine. The company actually contracted, probably now much to their dismay, developed a contract with me to examine whether or not atrazine was an endocrine disruptor, whether or not it interfered with hormone action. For those of you who aren't aware, atrazine is an herbicide, so it's a weed killer that's primarily used on corn in this country. It's been used since 1958, and we use about 80 million pounds per year. At the time, it was the number one selling pesticide in the world. It's now number two, I believe. It's used in more than 80 countries, but it's now outlawed in all of Europe, and in response to their lawyers, let me correct this slide, it has been denied regulatory approval in the European Union. The main point being that the company itself is based in Europe, so we're using 80 million pounds of something that they don't want in their own water. So we got asked to examine the effects of atrazine initially on frogs. I work on frogs. I'm a basic scientist. And we started working with this, the African clawed frog, although we collected ours in San Diego, so I guess technically they're African-American clawed frogs. But nevertheless, the point is, when you expose these guys to atrazine developmentally, you get sexual abnormalities such as the following. So these are the kidneys and gonads dissected from an exposed individual. And from the top, you might think this one is a male. But in fact, if you dig a little deeper, it's also a female. And then you have another testis, and you have more ovaries. And there's just a whole party going. You never have to leave home, I guess, when you're... What we discovered recently, and that work was published, and that was work that was originally done with funding from Novartis Syngenta, who then did not allow us to publish that work. We had to repeat the study completely with independent funding in order to get it published. And that was the end of my corporate funding and my work as a consultant. Subsequent to that, we discovered that when the animals are raised to sexual maturity, a proportion of the exposed males, genetic males, completely turn into females. So notice it's not one frog that hurt its leg and the other one's helping at home. These are two males copulating. And in fact, the male on the bottom was completely feminized by exposure to atrazine and actually lays eggs and for all intents and purposes is a functioning female. In fact, he's a grandmother now. You don't hear that too often. Our proposal at the time, and there was evidence for it that I'll continue to show you, was that normally males should make testosterone, the so-called male hormone, but we propose that atrazine turns on aromatase, which is the enzyme, is the machinery, if you will, that converts testosterone into estrogen. Testosterone is the male hormone. It literally means testicular hormone. It's two words stuck together. And estrogen literally means the generator of estrus. So as a result, the exposed genetic males are demasculinized because their testosterone is being metabolized, and they're subsequently feminized. We later went on to show that, in fact, if you look in the wild, there was a real risk. So this wasn't just a laboratory artifact. To give you an idea of the importance of atrazine in all of our lives and in the environment, the package of atrazine recommends application at 2.9 to 29 million parts per billion. That's 290 million times higher than we were using in the laboratory. To give you some idea of what's in the environment, this is what you'd find minimum and maximum in agricultural runoff, temporary pools, permanent water, and rainwater, and here's the level that we're using in the laboratory. So in fact, all of these environments would be at risk in the kinds of developmental abnormalities, deformities that I've talked to you about. There's enough atrazine in rainwater to chemically castrate and feminize frogs. 500,000 pounds of atrazine come down into rainwater every year, and it can travel over 1,000 miles. That's why the European Union got rid of it. France banned it, and then it was coming over in the rainwater from Germany. What's more is the EPA standard is 3 parts per billion. So atrazine is allowed in drinking water at levels that are 30 times higher than we're using in the laboratory. In our study in the field, we found that wherever we found atrazine contamination, and this was done in collaboration with a laboratory in Iowa and with a government laboratory, wherever we found atrazine, we found hermaphrodites. Now, I'm going to come back to this. This is just a correlation, except that we knew that we could reproduce these same types of effects in the laboratory and show cause and effect. At the time, I wasn't the only one studying atrazine. There were a number of other laboratories. My work shown in green here. There were a number of other laboratories showing a variety of effects of atrazine on amphibians. And that's all the work that you see stacked up here. And this is an old slide. This goes back to about 2007. So these were all of the studies that were produced by 2007 on amphibians. There were a few studies that suggested that atrazine had no effects. And lo and behold, as you might imagine from the topic of this symposium, all of those studies were produced by my former colleagues at Syngenta. And none of the studies that showed adverse effects were produced by Syngenta. So one of my solutions was I actually stuck to the peer-reviewed literature, and I published a paper that analyzed what were the most important factors determining whether or not you found an effect of atrazine. And it turned out, with a very significant p-value, funding source played a huge role in whether or not atrazine had any effect. Yeah, it was published in a nice paper in Biosciences. What's more is, these are now just the amphibian studies. In that same time period, these are studies on fish, these are studies on reptiles, these are studies on rodents, and these are studies on humans. So the data started to stack up. And as what you just heard, one of the company's strategy at the time was to generate doubt and to continue trying to stimulate studies that would show that atrazine actually has no effect. When the science finally started to stack up against atrazine, then, as you just heard, also my experience, very similar to Steve's, was the personal attacks. So they started writing letters to my dean. They started, I had a job offer, for example, at Duke University. They paid a huge amount of money to the graduate program there, and then somehow my job went away. Again, they wrote letters to my dean. I'm not sure why. I told them my daddy lives in South Carolina, but for some reason they think that the dean can tell me what to do. And a number of other personal attacks that I won't go into. My response was, again, to turn to the peer-reviewed literature as my source of support. So I actually gathered, when I was asked to write a review, this is one of the reviews we published, I gathered 22 authors from 12 different countries to write a review. And we have another one coming out where I gathered 40 to basically say that it's not just some crazy guy at Berkeley and frogs. There's a huge amount of data showing that atrazine is detrimental to environmental health and public health in general. In that first publication, we showed the following. So what you're looking at now are microscopic sections of the testis. And this one, these are controls, they're sperm, as there should be. And in this one, the testis is devoid of sperm because atrazine has depleted the testosterone. And this is from work we published fairly recently. This is one of my co-authors from Belgium who shows the same thing in fish. This is from a co-author in Argentina who's shown the same thing in alligators. This is from colleagues in Nigeria and also Croatia. Again, this is a rat test that's filled with sperm. You give it atrazine, there's no sperm. So this is work that we all published together, and more recently, a colleague from Pakistan has now showed that if you feed quail atrazine, the sperm goes away from their testis. So it's an effect that you're seeing across vertebrate classes, in every vertebrate class in existence, not just work that's coming out of my laboratory, as the company would have you believe. What's more is a colleague who also co-authored this paper, Shauna Swan, showed the following. If she looked at men in Columbia, Missouri, and showed that with a pretty significant p-value, that men who have low sperm count and can't get their wives pregnant have significantly more atrazine in their urine, about the same amount of atrazine that it takes to chemically castrate a frog or a fish. Now, I'll squash the data down because here's a colleague from California in 1993 published a study showing here's atrazine levels in field workers, and now I'll squash this down. Here's atrazine levels in men who apply atrazine, of course, mostly who are Mexican-American. So men who apply atrazine have atrazine levels in their urine that are 24,000 times what we know causes low fertility or is associated with low fertility in men in Columbia, Missouri. Or as I often tell my audiences, one of these guys could pee in a bucket and I could dilute it 24,000 times and use the atrazine in their urine to chemically castrate and feminize 24,000 buckets of 30 tadpoles each. Also related to humans, there's at least one study with a pretty significant p-value that shows that atrazine is associated with breast cancer incidence. And this is a study in Kentucky that compared women who live in areas with atrazine contaminated well water and use that well water as their drinking water compared to women who live in the same areas but don't use that well water. So again, it's just a correlation, except that when you look at rats, when you feed them atrazine, there's a significant increase in estrogen, and as shown here, a significant increase in breast cancer incidence in rats exposed to atrazine. What's more is if you look at human cell lines, and these are data from yet another laboratory that actually contained one of the Syngenta scientists co-authored this work. If you take a human cancer cell, in this case a kidney, carcinoma from a kidney, they don't express aromatase or make estrogen. You give them atrazine, and they start making estrogen. Just like we've shown in fish, just like we've shown in frogs, just like they've shown in reptiles, birds, and in rats, also in human cell lines. The significance of this is the following. A graduate student of mine showed that if you give a breast cancer cell atrazine, it starts expressing aromatase. It increases its expression of aromatase. Estrogen is incredibly important for breast cancer. As many as 70% and probably 100% of breast cancers start out estrogen dependent, which doesn't make sense when you consider that most women get breast cancer after menopause when their estrogen levels are lower than they've ever been in a woman's life. It turns out these damaged cells make aromatase and they make their own estrogen. And that estrogen locally, even though it doesn't circulate in the blood, is what turns these damaged cells into tumors and causes them to spread. In fact, the local aromatase expression is so important that the number one treatment for breast cancer right now is a chemical called letrozole, which decreases aromatase, decreases estrogen, and prevents those damaged cells from spreading. Doesn't make much sense when you consider that the number one contaminant of drinking water does exactly the opposite. It increases aromatase, increases estrogen, and promotes breast cancer in rats. Turns out, and this is one of the letters that they wrote to my dean, the same company made both compounds before they split off and changed their name. So somebody knew. So in addition, studies in rats now, which we use as a proxy for us, has shown that atrazine not only causes prostate and mammary cancer, but atrazine causes immune failure in exposed rats, something that we've also shown in the laboratory. Atrazine also causes neural damage when rat pups are exposed in utero. An EPA laboratory showed that atrazine causes abortion because of the hormone balances that it creates. Of those rats that don't abort, another EPA laboratory showed that the male pups, the sons, are born with prostate disease. A third EPA laboratory showed, and this is all published, that of those rats that don't abort, the female pups are born with impaired mammary development, such that when they reproduce, their offspring have retarded growth and development. So as a basic scientist who's really just trying to answer questions and test hypotheses, I was moved even more so by these data than my own. Because if you think about what I'm telling you here, this rat is affected by atrazine that its grandmother was exposed to. And so when I think about my own little girl, my own daughter, and the idea that my daughter's grandchildren could be impacted, could be affected by chemicals that we're applying today, moves me in a very different way as a most basic scientist might expect you to be, as I'll show in a minute. Fairly recently, a paper came out, and I'll just show you the conclusions. This is from the Center for Disease Control. Maternal exposure to surface water atrazine is associated with fetal gastroesthesis, particularly in spring conceptions, which is when atrazine levels are at their peak. One of my former undergraduates is now working on this problem, continuing to look at mechanisms that might be involved in this particular birth defect. And in fact, just last week, just a few weeks ago, on September 28th, a paper came out showing that maternal exposure, and I'm reading here from the paper, to a common herbicide atrazine is associated with a nearly twofold higher risk of having offspring with rare birth defects of the nasal cavity, choanoatresia. So again, these are just correlations, but we have the basic science to support that atrazine causes reproductive and birth defects, and yet, because of, I would argue, these same strategies that the industry has taken, we're not moving forward in having the science drive the legislation. As I said, I've come to feel very differently about when you become politically active. I've been accused of being an activist and an environmentalist and all kinds of things. And even my graduate advisor warned when I first got involved that basic sciences shouldn't be an advocate. You should let the science speak for itself. I find it troubling to accept this as my sense of responsibility when the industry says things like this on their website. They assume no obligation to update forward-looking statements to reflect an actual result? Who says shit like that in the first place? That's my first. But then when the EPA says the ultimate decision is much bigger than science, it weighs in public opinion. This was a comment that they made to the news media about my work and about the work of others on atrazine. If we as basic scientists don't make it our responsibility to bring information to the public, to bring data to the public, if we don't advocate, then how is the public supposed to have an opinion, which apparently our government is counting on, in order to make the appropriate decisions? So I don't have time to walk across the screen today, but I've crossed the line, so to speak, and I've been involved in setting up websites to make information to the public, sort of my solutions that I've taken, if you will. I helped a group of college students start a Facebook webpage so that they can follow the news on atrazine. I've been involved in helping organizations set up petitions to ban atrazine by helping explain the science. I helped Keith Ellison understand the science to write a bill to ban atrazine. And I was involved in, free of charge, helping the lawyers understand the science who just settled with Syngenta for $105 million. And I've been involved in a number of documentaries, including one where I got to be with Aaron Brockovich, who I originally met at the APHA meeting a few years ago. Finally, I follow and I suggest that we all follow a different philosophy than the let the science speak for itself. And that's the philosophy that those who have the privilege to know have the duty to act. So not only can you be both a scientist and an activist, at least according to one guy, you have the duty to do both. This guy said that. There's a quick question or a comment. So there's been some efforts. I worked quite a bit, for example, with state legislatures in Minnesota, et cetera. And it's, maybe we should talk about it later. It becomes very difficult because atrazine is so tied with economy in those places where atrazine would matter that an individual state doesn't want to say, well, we're going to give up atrazine because then they're going to feel that there'll be an economic disadvantage. And I find the same thing in interacting with farmers. I've interacted with farmers who say, yeah, well, we know this stuff is bad. We know that we're hurting people. We know that we're hurting the environment. But if I don't use it, and my neighbor grows 1.2% more corn, which is what atrazine gets them, than I do, then he'll own my farm next year. So it's a real, it's a long conversation that we probably want to save for the discussion. But I've tried. I've worked with local farming groups and with non-government organizations and with state legislators.